You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast for the edition covering the 14th to the 20th of November 2013. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by editor John Gill, deputy features editor Paul Jump, and for the first time, our new research reporter Holly Else. We will be talking grant success rates as we publish our annual analysis of Research Council grant data. The 1994 group is no more. What, if anything, does this mean for the sector? We'll ask John Gill. And we'll hear from Fergal Sharkey, who was lead vocalist for the Undertones, on what HE can learn from the music industry with particular regard to technological change. But first to you, Paul, and Holly, of course, as well. This week's lead news pages are all about the success rate of research grant applications. We do this every year. What does the picture look like?
Can I just say I'm glad to be here for once, not talking about the REF.
You kind of do that.
But research councils are the other thing I talk a lot about. And this is a sort of annual analysis that we do of the success rates based on their own figures. So any complaints, you can address them to the research councils. The overall story is that the success rates have gone up again for the fourth year running. Sort of overall success rate, looking at all the research councils, is up to 30%, which it was 28 the previous year, and it was only 23 in 2008-09. So it's gone up quite a lot. The obvious reason for this is the introduction of demand management, which was specifically introduced to try and improve the success rates at a time when several research councils had success rates of under 20%.
So how does that work? Basically, if you fail in an application, is there sort of restrictions on what you can apply for again?
Well, there are various models. The most controversial is also the first, which is the EPSRC. What they do is they look at, if you sort of make a series of unsuccessful applications, they then constrain you, as they call it, which means you can only make one application in the next 12 months. So that's the harshest one. Most of the other research councils just sort of prevail upon the universities to sift their own applications before they send them out and make sure they're up to scratch.
I mean, the councils can probably feel quite vindicated, can't they? Because we did reach a crisis point where the success rates were so low that probably the effort to reward ratio was such that actually, a huge amount of time and effort was being wasted. And as you said, in 2008-09, and it was very controversial when they started to introduce these demand management procedures. But when you look at it, 4 years of rising success rates, there doesn't seem to be the controversy surrounding this model now that there was then. Do you think they feel vindicated?
Yes, I suppose they do. I mean, partly there hasn't been so much controversy because people didn't follow the EPSRC's lead. Mm. The other councils have treaded a little bit more carefully on it. I mean, I suppose you can say the effort involved now is less. On the other hand, with all the internal sifting that's going on, the actual effort for each application is probably higher than it used to be. So whether the overall effort's lower,
so it's just been moved from the councils to the universities.
Well, that's what a lot of people would say, yeah. And from the councils' point of view, of course, that's a success because their operating budgets have been cut a lot recently, and they just don't have the manpower they used to have. So in a way, this is something they had to do.
Indeed. Well, there's loads of analysis on that across page 6 and 7 of this week's magazine. In fact, there's several tables to get stuck into as well. Holly, I understand you crunched the numbers on this story. Welcome to the Times Higher Education. It seems a good opportunity to ask you sort of what topics you'll be looking forward to getting stuck into on the magazine now that you've joined us.
Sure, so I'll be covering research policy, and I think the areas I'm quite interested in finding a bit more about are the links between universities and businesses, and especially the issues facing early career researchers. I know that's there's lots of issues there which can be really exciting to write about.
Yeah, they're really popular online as well. As hashtag ECRChat, that if you put on any tweet, you can guarantee it's going to get retweeted about.
One of the big issues for us as a magazine over the next few years will be, I suppose, postgrads and early career researchers, because there is such a kind of ticking time bomb there as far as the academy as a whole is concerned. If they're the classic story there, of course, is there just simply aren't the jobs you know, the bottleneck is people coming out looking for academic jobs and the number of posts available and the nature of academic careers now and you know, increasing casualisation and so on. So it's a good patch for you to have, Holly.
Yeah, I'm really excited.
Yeah, it will be interesting to watch. John, while you're talking, your editorial this week leads on the demise of the 1994 yeah. group of universities. We have coverage as well on pages 8 and 9 from John Morgan and David Matthews, who aren't here. But, I mean, its membership had sort of dwindled recently, hadn't it? We'd seen people leaving. We had a headline, I think, a year ago saying, we're the last one to leave the 94 group. Please turn the lights
on. Well, I mean, it's true. It's I mean, as I start the editorial this week, you know, farewell 94 group, you were looking a bit thin, but your demise was rather sudden when it came. I mean, was it last Thursday, last Friday, when it was suddenly announced by its executive director Alex Bowles that it was being shut? It was a shock, because all the indications had been that actually there was a diary date set this week for the 94 group to relaunch in a new souped up form, and our report suggests that it was going to be known as the Senate Group, that new members had been lined up to join, because you're right that it had dwindled. I think it had gone from about 20 or so members a couple of years ago to just 11 when it shut. So it had obviously shipped the four members who left to join the Russell Group, and then subsequent to that raid, four other institutions left to become just non-aligned institutions. And I think it says a couple of things to me. One of them is really about the kind of success that the Russell Group has had in kind of absolutely owning that ground as, you know, the, in inverted commas, elite institutions. You know, they've really, over the last couple of years, picked up an awful lot of momentum and actually done it's almost a brand, it's changed from being a sort of mission group to being a lobbying group to also almost becoming a brand now. You hear about kids of, you know, and ambitious parents talking about their children being on Russell Group track, and I remember being at a soiree held to celebrate one of the 94 group institutions joining the Russell Group, and their chair of council stood on a stage and talked about them having achieved the Holy Grail. I mean, it really feels at that end of the market that it's kind of Russell Group or nothing, and it's a real shame, because actually the 94 group, I think, had a very appealing concept of, you know, being a network of smaller but still research intensive universities with a very strong focus on students, the student experience, smaller class sizes. Edward Acton's at VC of UEA has written very interestingly about this for THE quite recently, and sorry, when you think about it, that actually speaks quite strongly to the whole government reforms of the last few years, having research informed but very much student focused university experience. I mean, what does it say to David Willetts that actually the students that he was hoping were being put at the heart of the system are opting very much to go for the sort of branded Russell Group tag, even though perhaps those universities aren't putting quite as much emphasis. I mean, they would probably dispute this, but, you know, I don't think many people would really deny that the Russell Group's emphasis very much is on research.
As well, the 1994 group was said, it was the research intensive smaller university. Yeah. It didn't make any bones about the fact.
No, and to tie the two stories that we've talked about together today together, if you look at the Research Council success rate stuff that Paul's been talking about just now, you look at the take that the Russell Group gets in comparison to the 94 group, and it is absolutely huge. I mean, the University College London, which is the highest earner, Paul, and how much last year? It was
135 million.
Right, and that's more than the whole, almost twice what the whole 94 group earned in total. So
that's right.
The scale that we're talking about here is quite out of whack. And one of the interesting things, I think, in our coverage of the 94 group is the comment that Dominic Shellard gave us. He's Vice-Chancellor of De Montfort University. And he said that a lot of these groupings, these mission groups that exist now, are as irrelevant to modern institutions as the old Warsaw Pact, because they impose a sort of false homogeneity on the sector. And actually, if you look at the 94 group, some of the institutions in there were very, very different from each other. Even in terms of research income, you've got Loughborough taking over 20 million a year, more than some of the Russell Group institutions. And then you've got two or three others in our Research Council story who earned less than a million in Research Council grants last year. So you can kind of see that well, as the 94 group put it in its announcement that it was closing, that they'd grown apart and some of them had changed in shape to the extent that the need for a group as it originally envisaged no longer existed.
Anyway, moving on. I was at the lovely Missenden Abbey last week, which is owned by the Buckingham New University and was the venue of the 2013 Guild HE conference. One of the speakers there was former singer Fergal Sharkey, who sang Teenage Kicks alongside a number of other hits, who was speaking about the lessons higher education could learn from the music industry about the impact of new technology. There's a full write-up on page 14, but I caught up with him after his speech to ask him what lesson from the music world the higher education sector should pay particular attention to.
You will find yourself inundated with opinion from all sectors, all thoughts. And the reality is that every single industry that has had to go through this process, including the print media, we're still trying to figure it out. No one has got a complete answer. So ultimately, you're going to have to look after your core business as best you can, whilst becoming very comfortable, even more comfortable than you thought you ever could be, with the idea of informed risk. And getting out there and trying and experimenting and trying to develop new ways of interacting with consumers and getting paid in the process, should you choose to get paid, whilst not stripping out the core of the business you're trying to run.
Sure. Well, this conference is particularly for smaller, more specialist institutions. Sure. I mean, do you fear for them more, do you think, than the larger ones? Has the online age of music allowed your smaller niche musicians more freedom?
It's why it has allowed them more freedom. Clearly it has. And the illustration I gave is a well-worn example in many ways. You can create a piece of music and have it available to billions of people in the online market within minutes. It's actually created more noise and more static. And I think that's ultimately what's been driving the pattern I was describing of my criticism of the long tail, where it's actually concentrated consumer taste more in the middle than it's ever done before. Quite the reverse of what was anticipated and what was expected. And I suspect exactly the same is going on in print media right now.
There are success stories, aren't there? Really niche musicians. He would never have found success at all without this revolution.
Name one musician that's actually gone out there and truly achieved success purely because of their efforts in an online world. Name one.
I mean, the typical examples would be your Ed Sheeran's and your... we're talking about the YouTube generation.
Now, by the way, I'm not in any way trying to be critical, because anything that's going to encourage a young person to be creative on any level, I just instinctively feel compelled to applaud and encourage and support. So I don't want to appear to be a naysayer in some way, but it's simply replaced one set of problems with another set of problems. Yes, you can get your stuff up there. Yes, you might convince a few people to give you some money for it, but the reality is you and 95 million other people are all trying to do the same thing right now. And ironically, and I suspect, well, it is, he seems to have owned up to it in public, that may have been some of what was driving Trent Reznor's decision to re-sign to a major label. It's quite handy when you've got some guy in an office in New York with $3 million in a marketing budget and the knowledge and the skill and the expertise, the network, to implement that and to help support and develop your career the way you would like to develop it, should you choose to develop it that way.
Yes, that was Fergal Sharkey speaking to me at the Guild HE conference last week, and you can read more about that, as I said, on page 14. That's all for this week's Times Higher Education issue review. You can find us on Facebook, on LinkedIn, you'll find us on Google+, and of course on Twitter. Do get in touch if you have anything to say about any of the stories in this week's magazine.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.